And then we have to ensure that they're actually followed through on. And that means getting the firearms from someone who currently owns firearms and becomes prohibited. It means ensuring that we have universal background checks so that if someone who is prohibited attempts to purchase firearms or ammunition, that that would show up and they would, in fact, be denied. So, you know, there are several different aspects of what we need to do a better job around policy. And then, of course, we need to
do... We have 10 seconds.
All right. We also need to do a much better job addressing misogyny and domestic violence from the start. That is, recognizing that there's real harm that occurs as a result of gender bias.
Julia Weber, I want to thank you so much for being with us. This clearly needs a much larger discussion. Implementation Director at the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, Giffords Law Center, named for Gabby Giffords. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful.
Good morning, everybody. This is your regular weekly host on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland, talking at you from my home in Southeast Portland. How are y'all doing this morning? So thanks Ty for letting that Buffy St. Marie song stretch out for its full length. Every once in a while, I like to hear that. Especially when I'm going solo like I am this morning. Yeah, that was a Buffy St. Marie with Carried On from her album Medicine Songs from a number of years back now. Always like to hear Buffy St. Marie. So So have other people watched that CNN documentary, Dreamland, The Burning of Black Wall Street? I watched that on Sunday evening. Thoroughly struck by the weight of the history and the suffering and the injustice that were depicted in that excellent film. I'd like to talk about that this morning. I understand there was also a History Channel documentary about the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, which I didn't get to see. Maybe some of you saw that one. I want to talk about reparations, redistribution, restitution, and related issues. That's what I want to talk about. 503-231-8187 is the number to get with me to talk about these issues. And I'll be just reading a little bit about this documentary first, and some other stuff, kind of setting the stage for this discussion. I always like to, you know, to have as much of a coherent, continuous discussion as possible. There's, you know, an hour goes by really quick, so if we kind of get too scattered, I have a tendency to jump here and there myself. So I hope you all don't enable me too much. But let's try to keep keep your comments directed to what I've been saying as much as possible to kind of build a conversation. We really don't get too many chances to do that in this society, to build a group conversation around important topics. Certainly on Facebook, it kind of happens, but it's sort of difficult. It can be, tends towards the sound bite. But here, you know, I like to, especially when I'm flying solo, I like to give people a little bit of chance, well, at least a few minutes, to expound upon what you have to say, to respond reflectively to the topic that's been thrown out. So, okay, this film, Dreamland, The Burning of Black Wall Street, was executive produced by LeBron James and Maverick Carter and directed by Salima Karoma. It premiered on CNN on Sunday night on the 100th anniversary, or the day before, I guess, the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre has come to be known. Okay, so those of you who listen regularly to my show, especially my second Wednesday show with Jacqueline Keeler, I heard first about it. I imagine a lot of you heard first about the really fascinating roots of the initial African-American population in Tulsa, how it reached back to the freedmen, who were the slaves of the so-called five civilized tribes, who had plantations and slaves, and then were uprooted, forced at gunpoint to on the Trail of Tears to march all the way to Oklahoma Territory and reestablish themselves. And initially they had those slaves, but then after the Civil War they were forced to give up, and they became the freedmen, and they became landowners and attracted other African Americans to the territory. Anyway, so let me just read from this on the RogerEbert.com website, a review of this film. To know the story of the massacre, one must first learn the origins of Tulsa. Karoma reaches back to the 1830s to unveil how the five civilized tribes, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, Creek, and Seminole, first owned black slaves in their native southern states. Upon the 1830 Indian Removal Act, Native American slave owners took their, quote, property with them on the Trail of Tears. Those that they, I guess a number of them were sold beforehand, because obviously it's going to be a difficult journey anyway. I'm sure that you can read up on those details if you want. The five civilized tribes even supported the Confederacy during the Civil War. For most, including myself, this is... who's writing this article, on the Roger Ebert. Robert Daniels writing this review. These revelations will come as a surprise. What they divulge is how African Americans, even among a group of similarly hated by white folks, still occupied the lowest rung in the American experiment. By the conclusion of the Civil War, that at least that's among the five civilized tribes who were the ones who adopted the trappings of white culture, aka civilization, by adopting plantation-based agriculture, which in the Southeast was, you know, the crops that they grew were the ones that were could compete in a capitalist economy, cotton, tobacco, and obviously they learned a lesson from the whites that having so-called free labor, enslaved labor, was a way to build up the wealth quickly. Okay, so by the conclusion of the Civil War, the reforming United States government issued the Creek Treaty of 1866. The order made the slaves owned by Native Americans into freedmen, granting them mineral-rich land that held oil. Tulsa not only became the oil capital of the world, attracting whites seeking fame and fortune, it created a black upper class located in Greenwood. That's the section of Tulsa that became known as the Black Negro or Black Wall Street. Because of segregation, African Americans needed to create their own schools, newspapers, such as the A.J. Smitherman-run Tulsa Star, pool halls, hotels, grocery stores, nightclubs, lawyers, doctors, and movie theaters like the Dreamland, owned by Lula and Josh Williams, hence the creation of the Black Wall Street. And this goes on. It was, by all accounts, a remarkable situation or reality for African Americans in the United States. I guess in some ways comparable to, you know, the Harlem of the Harlem Renaissance and to some other places where, similarly, African Americans created their own economy. And in, you know, in different ways, obviously not all those places were burned to the ground by white vigilante mobs, egged on by, you know, basically by the power structure, both the private and public power structure. But over the decades, as is becoming abundantly clear, those have been hit by various mechanisms such as redlining, the construction of freeways, so-called urban renewal, et cetera, which did actually hit Greenwood after it was reconstructed to a lesser degree, but reconstructed after the race massacre of 1921. So where I want to go with this, and hopefully a number of you have watched this documentary, and I've given you an initial flavor of it. I can't read this entire thing because it's quite long, but I hope enough of you have seen it or know about it in other ways. They talked about it again on Democracy Now! This morning. Amy Goodman has talked quite a bit about that episode in history over the last few days, including this morning. In fact, where the guest was talking about the issue of reparations. And so interestingly mentioned this, what was initially the initial one of the initial reparations, of course, reconstruction out of the Civil War did lead to significant reparations, led to massive, large numbers of African Americans becoming involved in the political process through voting and through actually attaining political power as elected representatives. They did begin to build up some share in the economy, some land ownership, farming, but they were also promised a 40 acres as the United States expanded west, but that never did happen. But as the guest whose name I can't remember right now on Democracy Now! This morning did say that at the same time, 160-acre land grants were provided to large, huge numbers of white families. And he made the point at the end that 45 million living white Americans continue to benefit from those land grants. of course, here in Oregon, we have our own particular part of that history, which I'd like to talk about as a component of today's discussion. The Oregon Donation Land Act was passed in 1850, offering 320-acre parcels for thousands of European-American colonists. And, of course, blacks were excluded almost entirely, not completely, because they were actually needed as a labor force for some of the more menial servant jobs and such. In 5 years, settlers would claim 2.8 million acres of native land, and this was before any treaties were signed. So you see where I'm going with this, this double, we talk about the two original sins of the founding of the United States, chattel slavery and the colonial theft, expropriation of indigenous land as establishing the basis for the massive wealth and expansion of the United States and its coming to be the power, world power that it was. And we see how it's played out over the years. And now we're talking in these years of reckoning, which see monuments to that history torn down all over, and challenges to the power of white supremacy coming in many, many forms, challenging the power of the police, and calling for some form of reparations, redistribution, restitution. Many aspects to this. I want to read from this article on NDN historyresearch.com about the Termination Act, which a termination period in the 1950s, which led to the theft of massive amounts of native indigenous territory starting in Oregon. So I'll just read from the conclusion of this, and then I'll open it up to your phone calls. Tribes in western states possess great untapped resources and lands, and the state and federal government sought to possess those assets for the benefit of the new settlers and for the growth of the western economy. Previous agricultural methods had degraded the agricultural potential of the Midwest United States, causing a great dust bowl. And the states of the region, this region needed more natural resources to rebuild. Untouched natural resources were to be had on tribal reservations, but access to them was limited by the continued existence of the tribes and the federal government who protected tribal sovereignty. Termination was termed an experiment by at least one Indian agent. Martin Holm, assistant area director of the Portland Area Office, declared Western Oregon will be a testing ground for Indian termination. That was 1954. He said that Holmes' statement on the eve of the termination of the Western Oregon Indians is telling. The federal government had never carried out such a policy as termination and did not know what would occur or how termination would affect Indians that had always been protected by federal trust status. The experiment was a politically propelled assimilative movement based on the economic needs of many levels of government and individuals and the continued desire to eliminate American Indians as a perceived liability. And that continues, important article. There's many others. David Lewis, of course, here, a former historian of the Grand Ronde tribe, still obviously a Grand Ronde tribal member, and sometime guest on this program, has written extensively about the termination period and the general history of the tribes of Oregon in the Northwest. So the one last thing I'll say, which is one of the central points that I wanted to make, was notwithstanding the fact that the Greenwood, the Black Wall Street, was created because of segregation and Jim Crow, because African Americans couldn't compete on anywhere near equal terms in the white-dominated economy and society, so they built their own in Oklahoma, based on the fact that this strange fact initially that the freed black slaves of the five civilized tribes were able to, because of the treaty that ended slavery with the five civilized tribes, were able to get grants of land, which African Americans weren't able to get as they had initially been promised as a reparation for slavery. Out of that land ownership, they were able to build up, and having a critical mass of people, a community that to build upon, land and community to build upon, they built up this Greenwood. So the point is that the white power structure, and I'm sure non-wealthy whites were jealous because they looked across the railroad tracks and saw these thriving African Americans. Of course, the vast majority were actually not wealthy, but they saw a black community that was, were equal to or even above their station. And the elites in Tulsa wanted that land because, I guess they had already built up the most attractive land in the rest of Tulsa. So they wanted that land to increase their wealth. So they, out of strange circumstances, they say it's the match, the spark that set off the powder keg, some incident apparently in an elevator where the elevator perhaps wasn't, they're old style elevators and they weren't always at the level of the floor that people were walking off from. And so it was a little lower, and this African American man's shoe shiner was going to use a bathroom in this building, maybe stumbled, stepping the elevator, stumbled into the young teenage white elevator operator woman, and someone heard her scream and interpreted it as a assault, and then that led to what happened. Of course, that was just a small part of the story. The people were looking to do damage to. I mean, people wouldn't have shot and killed and burned all those 1,000+ structures and just destroyed the black community if they weren't already in that frame of mind. So anyway, those two things, and of course, if you listen to Democracy Now!, you heard that more than 100 similar race massacres occurred across the United States from the late 19th century through the 20th century, into the 20th century, and then had a similar effect of the destruction of whatever wealth African Americans had been able to accumulate, similar to the way Native Americans were able to adapt, particularly in the Northwest, and also in the Midwest. There is a timber-based tribal economies. They had learned how to do that, so those were stripped from them and got into the hands of whites. So I guess the pragmatic point I want to make is that so who got all that wealth in Tulsa, across the country, in Oregon? Which private individuals and corporations? And should that wealth be redistributed? I noticed that in Dreamland, there wasn't there weren't names named of individuals, and they didn't really interview people. They interviewed some white people, but there obviously was quite a lot of reluctance because there didn't seem too many people that were like really heartfelt remorse for what had happened. I suspect that there's still a lot of potential blowback on people who really step out and speak seriously. I mean, this is from a total outsider. I can't say that, but I didn't hear anyone who actually was from a family that benefited from that horrible episode expressing their desire to give back. This land back movement, which I've been talking about with Jacqueline Keeler on the show and on my own, is something that's really gained a certain amount of traction. Both tribes on their own have been buying back land that was part of their traditional territories, and there are few but growing number of examples of churches and other and private individuals who are actually giving land back to Native Americans. And so it also applies to African Americans who, you know, I mean, that there's still gentrification going on. There's still people exploiting that the fact that that land is for 100 years was stolen from and taken from and not given back to the rightful owners, and there are still people benefiting from the fact that it is in different hands. So anyway, that's a very long introduction. I hope I've stimulated some people to want to interact with me. 503-231-8187. I also have a Facebook page at KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. You can like the page, and you can write a message to me at that. And I don't think I have anybody calling in just yet. 503-231-8187. Well, let's see. I just wanted to read a little bit. One thing that really struck me was that there is airplanes were actually used. I mean, people had gasoline and matches and used that to burn a lot of the property. But let me just read this article from 2017 from historicwings.com. On the morning of June 1, 1921, the Ku Klux Klan, I had not mentioned the importance of the Ku Klux Klan in that, and the white population of Tulsa made their move. At the sound of three blasts from a siren, they stormed the city's wealthy African-American district of Greenwood. The defending African-American citizens were ready. It had been a tense night of preparation. This was the battle they knew would come. Until the attack, Greenwood was a prosperous, wealthy, and well-educated community. Despite their prosperity, and maybe because of it, the African-American community had watched with increasing concern as the KKK steadily rose in power in the city. The Greenwood community knew they were in a fight for survival. They were committed to defend every block of the community they had built. Both sides were well armed. However, the KKK had one thing that the African-Americans did not: air power. The first firebombing of the city did not take place during the Second World War, but two decades earlier. It did not take place in some overseas conflict either. It took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was the first and only aerial bombing of an American city in history and didn't involve a war with a foreign power. Rather, it pitted Americans against Americans. The ruins of North Detroit Avenue, looking at Booker T. Washington. Oh, that's a caption to a photograph. Anyway, apparently they were airplanes from an oil company that were pressed into service by the city of Tulsa, by the municipality. And this article is all about the episode. It doesn't get to the okay, here we go. The air power. With the attack on Tulsa less than an hour old, a group of pilots from Tulsa's white community gathered at the nearby airport of Curtis Southwest Field. Almost certainly, these were the commercial flight crews working for the Curtis Southwest Airplane Company, a firm that had formed a year and a half earlier in 1919, and which, more or less, ran the airport of the same name. Southwest was the nation's first commercial interstate air freight shipping business, though that honor is forgotten due to what they did that day. The company was also a dealer for the Curtis Airplane and Motor Company, selling surplus government planes and new models from the Curtis Company to the general public. Between them, the pilots prepared about a dozen or more light planes. These were surplus World War I Curtis JN-4 Jenny training planes. Anyway, so they used these planes to strafe, to actually shoot at the people on the ground and drop incendiary devices on Tulsa. And I will note that actually there were incendiary devices used in the Battle of Blair Mountain around the same time against the striking miners in West Virginia, another footnote of history. Okay, so it looks like we have our first caller. Chuck has been patiently waiting. Go ahead, Chuck, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
So
go ahead.
I just have a couple of quick thoughts. One, thanks for doing this show. Two, I heard on the news a commentator about the massacre, if you will, said that there's well over 100 of these episodes that have occurred. You know, another prominent case was Wilmington, Delaware, or maybe it was Wilmington, North Carolina, one of the Carolinas, it's always, you know, the black middle class takes political power and economic power, and then the whites get angry and resentful and then wipe them out and do a pogrom of sorts. So what's coming up for me about this, one, the reparations is reportedly going to be, it's multi-trillions of dollars that's been kind of calculated of basically stolen generational wealth. But what occurs for me about this is that we're witnessing what has a new term for me, and that's state crimes against democracy. So a SCAD, if you will, state crime against democracy. We see it in when the sheriff runs a lynching. Effectively, this is not just a white mob rising up, but this is sanctioned by law enforcement authority. So, you know, I think that needs to be put front and center, that when the Tulsa massacre is discussed, it's framed not just as white mob, you know, but it's actually state-sanctioned crimes against our democracy. And so, you know, and I'm, you know, 9/11 was a state crime against democracy. The JFK assassination was a state crime against democracy. The failure to hold state authorities accountable has led to terrible acts of impunity. So until the movement can figure out how to achieve accountability and enforce it, then the authorities will continue to act with impunity, and our democracy will not move forward or evolve, and the republic will basically remain a kind of corporatocracy, I think is what we have. So I'm going to hang up and listen, and maybe others have thoughts on this. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, actually, that kind of leads into another of the directions I wanted to go with this. As we wait for Chris, Constant, and Marcos, hold tight just a minute. So yeah, I think the states that are now passing these voter suppression laws are the direct heirs of all these things that I've been talking about, the race massacre, what happened after Reconstruction and the reimposition of white supremacy in the South and elsewhere after the attempts at, as Chuck was rightly pointing out, instituting true democracy, true equality, by giving one person one vote and by, you know, bringing African Americans into the political process, which was totally reversed after Reconstruction, you know, as a political compromise, as it were, and you know, a black suffered another, you know, what, 75 years plus of Jim Crow, and continued, you know, slavery under another name, by mass incarceration, etc. And so, yeah, they're the same forces are at work. So I have an interesting article I will, if I get a chance, be reading, Does the U.S. Have a White People Problem, by Scott Nakagawa, on Substack.com. Actually, it's his own website. But before that, let's go to our next caller. Chris, you are on the air. Hello, Chris? Maybe not Chris. I think maybe our...
I don't have any callers.
No callers?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, I'm sorry. That was from our last show. That was from 2 weeks ago. Pardon me. I thought those names sounded familiar. So let me get at the right spot here. So yeah, 503-231-8187. So what is the response? I mean, we don't live in Tulsa. Unless there's someone listening from Tulsa, it'd be interesting to hear from you. You know, if you were living in Tulsa, what would you do in confronting this terrible legacy? Obviously, if you're, I imagine if you're black and if you're white, you would probably have different responses, but not necessarily at a political level. What is to be done, as Lenin once stated, and as I occasionally tongue-in-cheek say, but what is the response? I mean, you know, there's a policy response. You know, there's as Biden is talking about, change housing policies to, you know, redress historical issues of inequality, inequity in home ownership because of redlining, that is unfavorable lending policies, excluding many African Americans from the ability to get loans for home ownership. There are many different policy devices. Obviously, you know, the whole idea of affirmative action was a way which became a huge part of the political and cultural war that is still raging with us, and has led to Trumpism, you know, because, you know, so many white people who should know better, because they aren't really beneficiaries of corporate capitalism, have bought into the lies of, you know, that you know, affirmative action is a way to steal their hard-earned wealth, as opposed to actually a way to redistress massive historical inequity, et cetera. So yeah, there's the policy level, but, you know, I brought up something. What about, you know, what about the ill-gotten private wealth that was built up? Obviously, you know, what would it take to redistribute that? You know, obviously they've got, you know, the power, the political power, the police power, which tends to defend private property and corporate wealth disproportionately, and targets the victims of inequality, people of color, poor people, disproportionately, and so it goes. So anyway, this article by Scott Nakagawa, does the U.S. have a white people problem? He says, I'm not burying the lead here. My answer to the question posed in the title is no, the U.S. does not have a white people problem. We have a problem with economic and political elites who have used, quote, white as a bribe in order to get the majority, or at least an effective plurality of Americans, to serve as a popular front for an exploitative elite agenda. And why does this matter? Because unless we can drive a wedge between working class white people and those cynical and manipulative elites, we will never be able to build an effective pro-democracy majority in the U.S. Apropos of Chuck's point, which is that there continues to be these episodes of state action aided and abetted by private individuals and corporate interests against any attempts to truly establish democracy. And with, you know, the dwindling of the white majority and the rise of especially of Hispanic demographics leading to, and the, you know, increase of grassroots, kind of a resurgence of grassroots people of color activism, as Stacey Abrams in Georgia and some of the Hispanic efforts in Texas and Florida and elsewhere, to bring out the vote and to counterbalance the white hegemony. So there's going to continue to be these moves by the elites to bribe the white people, who are still a numerical what's the word, majority in terms of absolute, the greatest block of demographic group, you know, if you could say white people in general are a demographic block. Since we generalize Hispanics and African Americans or Latinx people and African Americans and others, I guess we can generalize European Americans or white people. So, continue with Scott Nakagawa. So, yeah, white identity is a problematic political construct, but that construct should be viewed as a cage, one that is holding white people and the rest of us captive to special interests that are not ours. That should make anti-racism a movement for political liberation. So if you ask me, we should stop calling people out and start calling for freedom, friends. In spite of this, I get a lot of backtalk and resistance when I point out that the importance of reaching out to white people, and especially conservative white people. I hear people of color say it's not my job to be reaching out to white people. I also hear white people saying that conservative whites are unreachable. Does that resonate with you? I mean, I certainly feel myself, I mean, God, with COVID, we all feel ourselves in various bubbles, which has really exacerbated in a lot of ways these divides. And, you know, frankly, exacerbated the conspiratorial nature of white paranoid thinking in this country, which has been fairly large scale. So, I don't reach out to too many conservative whites myself. Scott obviously works in milieus where they do that, and he gives a shout out to groups that are doing some of this vital work: United Vision for Idaho, Women's March, Rural Organizing Project here in Oregon, Kentucky Fairness Coalition, Highlander Research and Education Center, Showing Up for Racial Justice, and Firelands, among others. So, I mean, that's something that, you know, unless you're a hardcore organizer, you're probably not too involved in that work. But, you know, heck, I find myself in that, having those so-called Thanksgiving moments that we all do with people in my own family. Not to name names, but had a conversation with an in-law a few weeks ago who was in town, who was just refusing to acknowledge the reality of the inequity that African Americans have been subjected to, and I was talking about the, you know, just the use of so-called urban renewal and freeway projects. He said, "Oh, they were just dealing with slums." Like, yeah, that's what the propaganda would have you to believe. I mean, people still believe that stuff. So, you know, I tried to talk, and will continue to try to. But yeah, it is frustrating, you know, because people get into these hardcore mindsets, and frankly, it's a very deep-seated, you know, our worldviews become very deep-seated, you know, our deep psychological attachment. So, you know, it really takes the hard work of, you know, actually interacting on an ongoing basis, having friendships and such. And frankly, I'm one of those people who feels like we're also running out of time. So it's kind of this crunch. So anyway, I'm kind of going off on my own tangent. I've been reading from this number of articles, including Scott Nakagawa, "Does the U.S. Have a White People Problem?" So he ended this paragraph. I also hear white people saying that conservative whites are unreachable. On the first point about people of color saying it's not my job to be reaching out to white people, I think it's fine for people of color to opt out of reaching out to white people, but pushing them away with angry diatribes and demonization is a mistake. When we do that, we might get a lot of likes and retweets, but we close down the social and political space progressive whites need to reach out to conservative white voters. The success of that outreach will be contingent, I think, on progressives making the case that while racism seems nearly always to be part of the story when white voters choose reactionary leaders and policies, it is never, ever the whole story. Moving people away from racist ideas will require building on those other storylines to the point that they crowd out racist arguments. But for that to happen, we need to make room for those other storylines to get teased out. And he continues, but I really, really would like to hear what you've got to say. We've only got about 15 minutes left. We've only had one caller. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. Would really dearly love to hear from you. I've got a note from my my board engineer, Ty, saying author William A. Darity Jr. was on Democracy Now! Talking about the book From Here to Equality. Thank you, Ty. That is the person I was referring to who was talking about the issue of the Tulsa Race Massacre, its aftermath, the issue of reparations, and he mentioned these facts that African Americans weren't offered any kind of, I mean, they were basically just sink or swim, basically just thrown to the wolves, in the South especially, thrown to the wolves of the former white plantation owner class, ruling class, who controlled, you know, basically the politics and society in the South. They were thrown to the wolves from them, and they basically ended up largely working for a lot of the same plantation owners on some of the same cotton fields, et cetera, that they were, where they were slaves, or, you know, they started making in the Great Migration, they started making their way north and west. Not much to Oregon, because we had our exclusion laws, but a few, and then over the years, a few more. But, so the, the lynchings, Jim Crow, were mechanisms for enforcing that. And then, as I say, they didn't get any reparations. The idea was, through the westward expansion into indigenous territories, which has its own contradictory aspects, that they were promised 40 acres as the West in land grants, and they were never given that. That would have given people a leg up. Of course, it would have made them in ways complicit in the colonial expansion of the United States, but that's another story. While whites, through the allotment acts, were given 160-acre land grants provided to huge numbers of white families, hundreds of thousands, and 45 million living white Americans continue to benefit from those land grants, as, author William Darity Jr., who is on Democracy Now! This morning, was talking about in his book, From Here to Equality. Now, let me see. I might have... Oh, my gosh. We do have two callers. Sorry you came on and I didn't see you. Marilyn is our first on deck. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Hi, good morning. I was reminded of Greg Palast's quote from Charles Koch I believe that was in the Oklahoma Indian oil field. And he said, "I only want what's mine, and that's all of it."
Oh my God, I forgot. That's such a brilliant, that brings so many things together.
Yeah. Greg Palast is amazing. When he said that, he was already stealing oil from the Indians.
That's right. He built his fortune. So, the Koch family fortune, which then led to such, contributed to such massive distortions in our political system with the corporatocracy, was built upon the theft of Indian oil. Yes. Thank you.
And Fred Koch made his fortune working for Stalin. And he also created the refinery method of making high-octane gas that ran the Nazi planes and tanks and airplanes. And it's no surprise to me that they sent airplanes. And one of the witnesses in one of the OPB programs said that the airplanes came from the refineries, that the refineries sent the airplanes. And this is just something that oil companies do, or mining companies do. They go get what is theirs, and that's all of it.
Well, they killed Ken Sarawiwa in Nigeria. They massively suppressed indigenous opposition in the Amazon, all over the world. Yeah, you're totally right. So let me give you the word again. But so my call for reparations from private corporations, the Koch family should be number one on the list. And of course, they'll be fighting tooth and nail against any kind of reparations for sure.
And they have so much money that they can pretty much just take what they want. And they use the government, they use the Senate, Republicans to get whatever they want. And
true
they're
enough.
They're the ones that are pushing all the voter suppression laws.
Exactly, exactly.
From Heritage and from Mr. Koch and Mr. Satan, whatever you want to call him. And they have outsized influence because they have so much money.
Well, yeah, and it's a catch 22. You know, this whole the whole issue of you know the Mitch McConnell's stranglehold on the political process because of the you know the
he's a property of Mitch McConnell is a property of the Kochs.
Exactly, but the whole use the filibuster. I basically was going to say that you know there should be more of an urgency, and I think obviously the more progressive Democrats are certainly feeling this. I think Democrats as a whole should be feeling this, that there's a window of opportunity here that you know people are actually talking. You know, look at what Flynn said in Texas in this QAnon meeting about the you know the cheering on another coup attempt, the shooting down of the bipartisan committee on the January 6th insurrection. There, you know, the real possibility that the next presidential election could be stolen, and that the 2022 midterm elections, which are looming extremely large, that both these voter suppression laws and who knows what kind of you know behind the scenes manipulations.
Joe Manchin comes from a mining state, so they're coal, and they're also in on that thing. So we either need to skin him alive or pay him off, and I don't care which. But he needs to get out of the way.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, he's key to this. Anyway, so you brought up a huge number of points. The one about the Koch. The origins there in Oklahoma.
Oh, he's behind all of it. Yeah, they're behind all of it, and they own the GOP outright. And,
well, them and the other corporados for sure. That they have an outsized influence.
They don't say no to money.
Yeah, well, which rich white people do say no to money or. Anyway, so yeah, thank you so much, Marilyn. We only have just a few minutes left, and we've got one more caller. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Harry, you are on deck. Go ahead.
Oh, greetings, and thank you for taking my call. What happened in Tulsa was it was a race riot that led to a massacre, which means all this is just criminal. This is the major one I've heard about so far in the 20th century. I'm sure there have been many others of this, and not only to African Americans, but to the Native Americans. I mean, it hasn't been that long. I mean, the idea is still in living memory, and they even had survivors of the massacre, and they, you know, they told exactly what happened. But one thing about, you know, that and that part of the in the South was that during major disasters, hurricanes, floods, whatever, there was a lot of black farm workers, and a lot of them died during these things, and just the way they treated them. They put them in mass graves, right? But if you were white, well, you can be buried in a cemetery. And what happened? So in Tulsa, you have to think about the people who died were in mass. They put them in mass graves. How many? So they were saying 300 people died. We really don't know until they start finding more mass graves. Anyway,
well, they're finally doing that work apparently now, and they found in that film Dreamland, I think they found a 10 or a few more, but there's also more underway. So, of course, they also had the grisly accounting of piling them up, stacking them up on a flatbed truck and just dumping bodies in the river as well. So those people will likely never be found.
Oh, okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling, Harry. I also wanted to, you know, there's these brutal, overt massacres like the 100-plus that were mentioned by William Darity that happened from 1898 or before on. He mentioned 1898 in North Carolina and many others. You know, there also were the, you know, massacres through the so-called Indian Wars, Wounded Knee, Sand Creek, and on and on and on and on. But then there's the, you know, the massacre that came from the Termination Act. How many Klamath people, how many Grand Ronde, how many Siletz, how many Coquille, how many of these other tribes died because they lost their land base and their community, and their lives and families spiraled out of control through alcoholism, through poverty, through losing connections, et cetera. Those have never been counted. How many African Americans have died because of gentrification, because of losing their land from freeway construction, from so-called urban renewal, et cetera? There's these, policy decisions, huge economic forces that have unequal results, et cetera. So it's a grisly process, and I guess I continually want to get back to the point that Scott Nakagaw was drawing, was as conscious, you know, people with a certain amount of agency, maybe we don't feel we have as much as we would like, which is certainly true, certainly compared to the Koch brothers and Mitch McConnell and others of their ilk. But there is organizing work being done. What can we do, to have some measure of reparations, restitution, redistribution? We have a certain measure in our own lives. I keep calling on this show for people to pool together, not just our efforts through organizing and organizations and political power, but through economic power. KBOO, people contribute to KBOO. That's one way of sort of delegating your economic power to something that you believe in, that strives to sort of amplify voices that aren't heard and amplify organizing efforts. But also, we don't have enough infrastructure, community infrastructure. You know, the Black church was once, still is, but less and less was a major force of a sort of community infrastructure, organizing community, and that, because of displacement, gentrification has been dissipated. Same for other, unions have lost their clout. Union halls go largely unutilized, other than by the dwindling number of union members, except for a few, some of the public unions and others. Let's use our union halls. Let's use our churches. Let's pool our resources to develop other kinds of community centers. We do have co-ops, but those are some of the things that I think about a lot. I'd like to see many more community enterprises, community centers in the area where I live. I would like to pool together with people. I know, for example, the Montevilla Co-op has been gathering members and hopefully is on finally a site selection search. And, certainly I get a lot out of a People's Food Co-op where I mostly shop because it's in Southeast. But there are others. Let's find ways to to amplify our economic power like they did in Greenwood. You know, I'm sure you have your own ideas, but it looks like my ideas are at an end for today. I've read from a number of articles by Scott Nakagawa. Does the U.S. have a white people problem? I read from Dreamland, The Burning of Black Wall Street, on the RogerEbert.com website, an article on NDN website about the termination period. But that's it for today. Thank you to my board operator, Ty, and thank you to all for listening and those of you called in. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO. Bye-bye.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude?
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Barry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.